out Franklin Matters Radio Show number 661 in the series. This session of the radio show shares the Strong Towns Town Hall event with Congressman Jake Auchincloss, State Rep Jeff Roy, Franklin Town Councilor Kobe Frangillo, and Charles Mahrone from Strong Towns. The event was held at the Black Box and broadcast via Franklin TV and Zoom. After a round of opening remarks, there is a question and answer period with audience participation. The recording runs about an hour and 14 minutes, so let's listen to the Strong Towns event on November 15, 2021.
It's great. Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming. It's a good little crew we got here. Yes. Hi. Okay. Hi, everyone. All right. We're learning. This is good. Before we get started, just a few notes of thanks, and the big thanks will go to the people at the Black Box who are always very accommodating and always helpful to promoting local events. So a big round of applause to the Black Box.
Kobe, I didn't know you were a rock star. You hold that microphone like a rock star. I like that.
This better is not professional.
Again. You go for it.
Good luck.
You're doing great.
Some other things. Big thanks to Representative Roy, who helped be the glue to pull these pieces together. A big thank you to Congressman, who had quite a few good excuses to not be here and made his way here anyway, and we appreciate that. And a special thanks to Chuck for all you've done to help me be a strong local leader. I am joined here by some colleagues. So if you don't know me, my name's Kobe. I'm a town councilor here in Franklin. I'm joined by my chairman, Tom Mercer, and my fellow councilor, Mel Hamblin. Thank you guys for coming. So I found Strong Towns, and I don't even know if Jake knows, sorry, if Congressman knows this, but I found Strong Towns when I first started running, thinking of running a year ago today. I was just started inhaling every bit of information that I could around how to make our communities stronger, and just learned everything I could about urban planning. And I found in the bio, before he was a congressman, when he just started running, he had in his bio, at Strong Towns. And I clicked on that, and that opened up a whole new world of information. And I use a lot of different resources. Strong Towns is the primary resource. They have so many good articles and videos, and just a lot of thought leadership, and they're very articulate about how we make stronger communities. So I'm really, really happy that we're able to pull this together. A quick note about why I love Strong Towns and how we're starting to apply that in Franklin. I think that one of the things that Strong Towns touched upon is how the one small place where we're able to transcend some of partisan politics has been the local level and making strong places. And people on both sides, right? Some of our most progressive communities create some of our most unsustainable and unequitable places. And some of our most conservative leaders still promote strict government regulation that undermine, you know, market tendencies and some traditional knowledge. And so what Strong Towns is able to do is speak to everyone and recognize that we need to create spaces that are financially solvent first, and that promote a quality of life that we all want to enjoy. How we're starting to do that in Franklin. So I love Franklin. Welcome if you're not from Franklin. Welcome to this great town. We're very proud of a lot of things going on here, and we're especially proud of this, of our downtown here. But we're starting to notice that's similar to downtowns across really the country. We're starting to notice, we've had economics move toward the edges of town, and we're starting to, sort of in the post-war suburbanization, we were as privy to starting to put money on the edges of town, really starting to spread out, and we're starting to recognize the loss that that's had on our community. It's hard to financially sustain the model and development pattern that we've had over the past few decades. And we're really losing what still remains our most prosperous place, which is our downtown. We're letting it starting to slip behind. So we just allocated at the town $125,000 and got a $75,000 grant from the state level that's allowing us to do a full downtown diagnostics of our downtown zoning. And so over the next 6 months, we're really going to be collecting community input and looking at how we create a downtown that is more prosperous and lively and vibrant and with high return to Franklin. So that's it for me. I've rambled longer than I should have. The one last note is I do really appreciate Representative Roy and Congressman Akplus being here. So much of what we do at the local level is due to our strong partnerships with both of them. We are incredibly, incredibly lucky to have the leadership that we do here in Franklin. None of what we do exists without some of the, how they choose to spend funds and how they choose to support our community. So thank you guys both for being here. And I'd like to introduce Representative Roy, who I get the pleasure of working with in my day job almost every day.
Yeah. What are you doing here?
I know. I'm on the clock.
Well, thank you, Kobe, and thank you for your enthusiasm in what you bring to the town of Franklin and in your role up at the State House as a researcher for telecommunications, utilities, and energy, doing some great work up there. I do want to take this opportunity. I know some of my colleagues from the State House are here with us today. That's Representative Dooley, Representative Vitolo, Representative Hawkins, Representative Scanlon, and I saw Representative Dykema make the way in here. So thank you all for being here, and I want to welcome everyone to Franklin and the Black Box Theater. Just about 2 weeks ago, I was sitting in this very spot watching the pageantry of Mary Poppins performed in this tiny little theater, but it's a grand production. It was incredible to watch it right here in this community with Broadway actors and local actors on one stage together. And for me, this particular room and this particular space really represents a lot of work that we do in the community. 10 years ago, I was the chairman of Franklin's Master Plan Committee, and we created a list of things that we needed to make our community stronger. And one of the things that was top on the bucket list was to get a performance venue in the center of town. And about a year later, Raylan Mercer, who's up in the back of the room, approached and said, "Listen, I'd like to put a performance venue in downtown Franklin. What do you think of that idea?" And I said, "That's a big check mark on the master plan bucket list." And what it's done to draw people into this downtown space is incredible. And I think of some of the other things that we did in that work was some zoning changes so that we could get more transit-oriented housing. That has led to approximately 185 units within a walking distance from this space. We have a train station, which is about 200 feet from where we sit today. There's another large project that was done down by the Forge Park train station, making these places accessible to people who wanted to commute. We have done some development of our rail trail, and it was state and local efforts to build a tunnel along that rail trail to give us more accessibility to other communities, to encourage walking, biking, and other activities on the rail trail. We've benefited from both local, state, and federal funding, thanks to our great Congressman Jake Auchincloss, to keep a venue like this with the shuttered stage appropriations. This facility did benefit from that, but it wouldn't be without the involvement of a congressman who has spent a great deal of time in this community, learning about the people in the community, learning about the needs and what he can do to contribute to making this a strong town. And all of these things that I just talked about really require great interrelationships between local officials, state officials, and federal officials. And that's why in putting together this program, we really wanted to highlight what the three levels of government do together and how important it is to develop and build on those relationships. And I can say that some of my strongest relationships are with the officials, both in the local government and on the federal government. And the fact that so many of my State House colleagues are here today speaks volumes about how we all work together and try to do what's best for our communities. So that's what I wanted to say about this type of event, and I'm so thrilled that we have folks from throughout Congressman Auchincloss's district here today. I had breakfast with the Brookline contingency this morning. Great to see you folks, and great to see so many who are here from the community. And Kobe, this is a rookie era, but you neglected to represent your great town administrator, Jamie Helen. But I see him back there, and we don't want to miss. He's been town administrator, what, 2 years now? 3 years. My God, I'm getting sick of you. Great to see you here, and great to see members of the town council here today. But at this point, I want to introduce Congressman Jake Auchincloss, and many of you know the congressman, but for those folks who don't, and for those folks who may be watching this at home or online, just a few words about Jake. He was born and raised in Massachusetts. He's a son of a surgeon and a scientist, and they taught him the values of curiosity and integrity. And Jake and I share a love of history. And Jake, I'm going to embarrass you by sharing this story. One of the first times I met him, he knew that I loved history, and he brought me a book about the history of the American Revolution. And I said, how can I not love this guy? He gets it, and I thank you for that, Jake. But after graduating from Harvard College, Jake joined the Marines. He commanded infantry in Afghanistan and special operations in Panama, and he's now a major in the reserves. He commanded the infantry in Helmand Province in 2012 and a reconnaissance unit in Panama in 2014. In Helmand, he led combat patrols through villages contested by the Taliban. And he also served as a member of the Newton City Council, and I know Holly Ryan from the Newton City Councilor, and Ms. Albright is David's mom, is how she introduced to me. I don't know if you remember, but David Albright was my campaign manager in 2018, so the Albright family has a special place in my heart. So he served with them on the Newton City Council, and he was also at a cybersecurity startup as a product manager and at Liberty Mutual as a senior manager. Elected to Congress in November of 2020, and I want you to listen to these committee assignments that this one-year freshman in Congress has. He's on the Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure. I know that's an important topic for today. He's on the Committee on Financial Services, and subcommittees include Highway and Transit Subcommittee, Railroads, Pipelines, and Hazardous Materials, and the Subcommittee on National Security, International Development, Monetary Policy, and the Subcommittee on Diversity and Inclusion. Again, he's a frequent visitor to all of our districts, and it's my great privilege to welcome and introduce Congressman Jake Auchincloss. Jake, all yours. I welcome you.
Representative Roy, thank you for the warm introduction. Kobe, thank you for the welcome and for helping to coordinate this. And to the Black Box for their wizardry in getting me here in disembodied form. I really appreciate it. I want to extend also, Jeff, your welcome to the state representatives in attendance, the local elected officials and administrators, and Senator Becca Rausch as well, who I know is with us and who represents Franklin in the State House. I have been really looking forward to this event. I am as Kobe mentioned, a Strong Towns disciple. And I came to Strong Towns after my first term as a city councilor in Newton, where I served on the Land Use Committee and on the Transportation Committee, where we were grappling with issues of housing and transportation planning. And I noticed this increasing gap, this delta. On the one hand, there were those who opposed development of any kind. And that clearly felt wrong to me. There was a dire need for more housing in the greater Boston regional labor market, and also for the vitality of our cities and towns and our downtown villages. We wanted change, we wanted it. On the other hand, it felt like that change was coming in a very top-down fashion, where in order to engage in that development, you had to be a deep-pocketed developer who could write big checks, who could navigate multi-year-long planning processes, who could wage pitched political battles to get these developments approved. And it felt increasingly like we're at this fork, where on the one hand, there was nothing, there was stasis, no change. On the other hand, it was a top-down, pitched battle for massive change. And what Strong Towns offered was a middle path, an organic evolution that appreciated the complexity that is our cities and towns. They are not something that can be blueprinted. They are something that has to evolve over time and that benefits from organic, creative, incremental change. And I found that to be deeply consonant with my own approach to politics and to the intersection between government, business, and civil society. And as I've tried to educate myself more and more about the Strong Towns approach, I've seen that it has applications to a lot of the issues that we care about. The Strong Towns approach to development is better for our carbon footprint. It is better for public health. It prizes walkability and local retail. It is sustainable to me in the deepest sense of the word, which is that it leaves a town, a place, better off than you found it for your kid. That means not just more environmentally sustainable, but also more fiscally sustainable. Because too many of our towns, and I think this is especially true in Massachusetts, have gotten themselves over the post-war era overextended in terms of expensive surface and subsurface infrastructure that has become more expensive than the property taxes on top of it can sustain. And here again, Strong Towns offers an approach to sustainability that has both a fiscal and an environmental lens to it, and that is something that can help heal the local politics surrounding development and transportation planning. We've been asking our local administrators, we've been asking developers, I think, to do far too much. We've been asking them to be demographers and economists and urban planners and education experts and to see 10 to 15 to 20 years down the road and predict exactly what school enrollments will be and to predict exactly what demographic makeups of cities and towns will be, and it's unrealistic. I think that Strong Towns liberates local officials to focus on the things that they can do best and the things that they can control, and allows the market and civil society and the people to change gradually and incrementally over time. So I'm not here because I'm going to this afternoon join a number of other elected officials at the White House to sign the bipartisan infrastructure agreement, which is going to send an unprecedented amount of infrastructure funding to Massachusetts cities and towns for water infrastructure, for transportation infrastructure, for high-speed internet. And I view this as a uniquely propitious moment and just a wonderful opportunity for us to have a Strong Towns conversation, because it's an opportunity for Massachusetts cities and towns to take this infrastructure funding and to approach its use in a Strong Towns mindset. We've been calling this part of the Build Back Better agenda, and I strongly support it. At the same time, I know that Washington does not actually build anything. People who are going to be building are in Franklin and Brookline and Hopkinton and Fall River and Taunton. It's going to be at the local level, the most effective level of government in the United States, and the one that actually is going to be responsible for how this country truly heals and builds back better from the pandemic. So, Chuck, I'm so thrilled that you're here. Love to hear your thoughts on capitalizing on this moment of federal funding to build a strong town's future.
Hey, thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you, yes. Thank you, everybody who's come out today. Representative, I appreciate the invitation. Appreciate you hosting us and having us here. My name is Chuck Marone. I'm the president and founder of an organization called Strong Towns. I flew in from Minnesota last night. I'm spending the day here today in Massachusetts. I'm actually going to Tucson tomorrow. I added this on to the beginning of this long trip I've got in the southwest of the country because I want to invest in this relationship. And it's not the relationship that I have with this community or I have with any of you or even the congressman. The relationship I'm trying to invest in is the one between Jake and this community, between Kobe and Jake, and this whole, I think, changing relationship of what it means to be a public official. At the end of World War II, we were trying to solve what was a very complicated problem, but in retrospect ended up to be very simple. We were trying to stay out of the Great Depression. We had escaped, in a sense, a raw sense of growth and employment, the throes of the Great Depression, by having a world war. And we're taught in middle school that the way we solved the Depression was World War II. And it's a ridiculous statement because none of us want to ship millions of people overseas to kill and to die, to take all this working age capacity we have and put it into building bombs and munitions and tanks and what have you. But when the war started to wind down, when things started to become clear that we were going to win, it was just a matter of time and energy, the economists around FDR at the time started to freak out and say, how do we not just slide right back into depression? When we bring these millions of troops home and demobilize, when we shut down all these industries of war, how do we not just go right back to 1935? And the way we didn't go back to 1935, the way we came up with something different, the way we stayed out of the Great Depression, again, 2.0, was to invest in this new version of America. We built the interstate highways. We took and invested unprecedented amounts of money in sewer and water infrastructure. We took all of this capital that we had, all of this social capital, the wealth that we had created, the industry that we created, and we pumped it into building a new version of America. And today we look back at that period of time, the decades right after World War II, as this time of great change, great prosperity, great hope. We even label it the American dream, right? One of the consequences of those choices, and I start with this because I want to make sure that we're being as generous as we can with the people of that era and also understand how we got here. It is ridiculously easy to grow the macro economy, the national economy, if you are willing to have cities take on long-term liabilities. We can build another mile of pipe on the edge of the city, and we can get all kinds of growth and development from that. It's a very simple process to do. But now the city, the community, has a mile of pipe to maintain. That bill won't come due for decades, but when it comes due, it's a real liability that shows up on our balance sheet at the local level. We can build a mile of road and have a whole bunch of growth that comes from it and a whole bunch of new houses and new businesses, and that's very exciting and it feels like success. And if you measure success at the federal level, if you measure it by GDP growth and unemployment and kind of some base macro statistics, it feels very, very successful. But if you measure it at the local level, where that road is not just an asset that we can build on, but also a liability that we as a community have to maintain, the equation becomes much different, particularly as you go out in time. At the end of World War II, we were trying to solve a problem. How do we create enough growth to go back, to stop from going back into depression? Today we have a much different problem. The problem we're trying to solve today is, how do we make better use of all this stuff we have already built? How do we actually wring out of it more value, more productivity, a higher quality of life, a greater level of prosperity for the people of this community? We have tons of liabilities now at the local level. And you can see in the infrastructure bill that the representative is going to sign today some acknowledgement of that fact, some acknowledgement of the fact that we have these responsibilities that we as a nation have created at the local level that we need to help make right, help take care of, help, you know, figure out. But the relationship that I'm investing in is the one that looks, as the representative has indicated, he is a former city council member. He's been in the trenches, he gets this, he knows the struggles that we have here. And the thing that is special about this moment is that you in your district here have a representative who looks and understands that the role is not for local policy to serve the macro needs of the economy, but for the macro economy, for the Congress and the structure and the infrastructure bill and the spending we're doing to actually serve the needs of local leaders and what they are identifying today as the essential things that need to be done. What do those things look like? They look a lot like basic maintenance. How do we take care of the pipes under the ground? How do we take care of the sidewalks? How do we take care of the older neighborhoods that have so much financial productivity, so much potential upside that have been neglected for so long? How do we build biking and walking infrastructure? Because as the representative said, you know, not only is it kind of the greenest thing that we can do, the most sustainable thing we can do, but it's also the most family-friendly, economic-friendly thing that we can do. If we can help a person, if we can help a family go from having two cars to having one car, we utterly transform their local economics. And we create lots and lots of capital that can be reinvested in this community. How do we help local businesses stand up in an environment where, you know, we have tons and tons of bailouts and lots of money that are poured into corporations and large industries coming in, and really not enough love being shown to those local startups? How do we create that environment where they can step up? They can be part of the answer. They can chase their dreams and actually see a place for them here. We all want that. We all want to see that happen. How can we make that occur? And how do we get more housing? How do we allow our neighborhoods to evolve and to adapt over time? How do we allow, instead of having the fight over the one big development that's going to change our community in a way that we don't want to see, how do we have the debate be about thickening up our neighborhoods, making better use of those infrastructure investments we've already made, but also leaving our neighborhoods better off in the future? How do we take that single family home and find a place for that college student to stay in the accessory apartment? How do we take that that single family home and allow it to become a duplex and allow that family to have the money to stay in that house, to maintain their roof and fix their essential needs? How do we allow that family that wants their mother-in-law to come back and be able to live with them and not wind up in a home and have all that expense, but actually want to have the love and the family togetherness of doing that? How do we allow them a mechanism to actually do that in a way that families have done for thousands of years? This is a great moment because it's a moment where we can actually take the macro action, the federal action, and connect it in kind of a service way, in a leadership way, to the local conversation. And I'm really excited to be here today to chat with you, to answer your questions, and to be part of this relationship that is really the most critical relationship we can have right now in the U.S. is this federal to local relationship, with the local leaders being the ones that are directing where we're going. So thank you so much.
You may notice that right in the center of the hall there's a microphone. So if folks have questions, step right up to the microphone. And I want to give my apologies to Senator Rausch. I did not see you come in, and it's great to see you here this morning. And thank you for being here. So who's first on the questions? Well, they're not going to make this easy.
It's
for
all
you.
Right.
There you go. I got plenty, so. Be okay.
So I'll be the first. Is this on? Can
yeah,
you hear me?
Just okay. Fine.
Hello, Congressman Auchincloss.
Hi, Councillor Albright, Council President.
To be my colleague in my ward. So we just had an election in Newton, And the primary issue in that election was, what, you're going to eliminate single-family zoning?
Yeah.
Several of the councilors on our council took that as an issue and for a year hammered away at it. Look what that council is going to do to you. They're going to ruin Newton. So what is the messaging that you've seen work? Have you seen any that works? But what is the messaging that we can use with our constituents? You know, they have the $5 million house here and the $4 million house. And frankly, you can't buy a house for much less than $1 million in Newton anyway now. So what is the messaging that gets to people that doesn't say we're going to ruin their community by adding duplexes wherever they need, wherever they can organically evolve?
So I don't want to step in and answer every question before you guys have a chance, because I think everybody here has important things to say. Let me try to address that. And I'm going to address that acknowledging that I don't know your community as well as the other people here do. And so I think they may have some more important things to say than I do. I do think that one of the things, I was in Bend, Oregon last week, and Bend, Oregon is a very progressive place with a really high cost of housing and a high cost of living. And one of the things that they have done, because they just passed statewide, but also locally they had before they did statewide, a change in their code that would not prohibit single-family homes. You're welcome to build a single-family home if they want, but also don't make exclusive single-family home neighborhoods. I think that's the first change I would make, is to talk about it in terms of we have exclusive single-family home neighborhoods, and then we have neighborhoods that allow other things. And I think the idea of exclusive single-family home neighborhoods is something that is very unpalatable for a lot of people. I think we need to frame this in terms of intergenerational existence. Everybody who owns a home today and is seeing that home rise in value is appreciative of the fact that their house is worth more today. In fact, a lot of us depend on that, or a lot of people depend on that in a way that I think is dangerous for our local economy. But all of those people also see the need or the desire to want their kids or their grandchildren or next generations to be able to be a part of that community, to live in that place. And I think we need to define the changes we're doing in terms of this intergenerational capacity. We don't want to kick out the elderly in our community. We don't want them to not be able to live here. We don't want our youth to leave and never be able to come back. We want them to be able to come back and not as, beholden to debt, not as slaves to debt, not as people who must, you know, do this stuff in order to make their debt payments to live here. We don't want that kind of life for them. We want a better life. And so I would talk about it in terms of intergenerational living. I also think it's very, very important to talk about just the flexibility. I know just yesterday on Twitter there was an interesting conversation that I was having with some people who had made changes in their districts, and their districts were 55-60% red over blue. So these were conservative places. And they were talking about property rights, and they were talking about the freedom to do what you want with your property, and they were talking about jobs and economic development. I think that some of those things are things we can talk about to a degree here too. I think we can talk about the capacity for people to take their house and make better use of it. The situation I brought up earlier where the family is struggling to fix their roof is a very real one that we see a lot. It's a very real one that people experience. The idea that you could take that spare bedroom you have, convert it into an efficiency apartment, rent that out, and use that rental income to fix your roof is something that was available to people 100 years ago and that we've taken off the table today. And so there's a very human thing for allowing people the capacity to stay in their home and make good use of it. Last thing, I think we also have to acknowledge that the people who resist change and evolution in our neighborhood are not completely unjustified. A lot of the things that we have done historically over the last generation or more have been these massive transformations where we go from a neighborhood that we can identify with, that we grew up with, that we like and have chosen, to something that in a very short blink of a time is unrecognizable. And I think we should acknowledge that the rapidity of that transition is something that, as humans, it's not wrong to want to resist. We should say up front, I don't want to take your single family home neighborhood and make it into six-story condo units. That's not what we're trying to do. But if we don't allow neighborhoods to breathe and evolve, we create all of this pressure and tension, and the only outlet we have for it are these large transformations. And that's what we're trying to move away from.
Thank you. We may need you to come and talk to us.
I'm happy to.
Yeah. Do we have a question already?
While we're waiting for somebody to get up to the mic, I know you said you had a question.
Sure.
Dive in.
I think a big one that comes up when we talk about, okay, a new development's coming in, and can we afford it for the community? What you hear a lot is the education question, right? This is going to have an impact on our schools and sort of our it costs so much for our town to send a new school kid in a way that makes it sound like, oh, how could we ever grow because of our schools? And what you focus on mostly is infrastructure liabilities. How do you differentiate those? Do you differentiate sort of when there's new growth, what is the impact that it has on our infrastructure spreadsheet, and what's the impact that it has on education?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So as we grow, we have all these large fixed costs. We get a certain number of people and, oh my gosh, we need a new fire station. And we get a certain number of people and, oh my gosh, we need a new school. And so we're trying to avoid like these big ticket expenditures. And the interesting thing is that when we, I'm going to say this, and this will be a little bit dissatisfying, I think, but I want to put this thought out there for people to marinate in. When we look at this today, what we have to recognize is that we have come up with a certain approach to education, a certain approach to fire service, a certain approach to public safety, a certain approach to providing water. You know, we got a big water tower we got to put in now because our growth. And it's all kind of predicated on the big transformative project. What we have given up, and if we go back 100 years and look at our ancestors and others who lived in this community, what they did is they had intermediary things that they would do, transitionary things that they would do to meet those same needs, but at less of a scale. We've lost that capacity. And I do think that part of the answer here, let me say it this way, I don't think the answer here can be that we don't welcome others, that we don't continue to thicken up our communities and grow, because that is an urgent need that we have too. We do have, when you look at the balance sheet of the community, far too many roads to maintain than we have tax base, far too much pipe to maintain than we have tax base. We actually need to, in a critical way, make better use of this stuff. But some of those other things, like education, we have to find a way to do that at different scales, as opposed to just one scale, which is big. We have to find a way to do neighborhood level schools at lower cost. We have to be able to find a way to do neighborhood level fire policing and firefighting at lower cost, so that every time we trigger one of those, it's not a big ticket item. I think that is more of a function of how we have chosen to solve those problems and deliver those services, as opposed to the services themselves being something we don't want to pay for.
Right, I see you got a question, and then we'll take Sarah.
Hi, Brett Feldman. I served on the Finance Committee and the Town Council in Franklin, and the thing that I hear over and over again is the term unfunded mandates, right? Whether it's from the state or federal level, and whether it's education or environmental remediation or public safety or whatever it might be, that drives a big wedge between the local level and higher levels. How can we break that cycle of unfunded mandates?
I think we should let Representative Hockenclaw take that one first, if you would like to. Did you hear that question, Jake, about?
I did.
Okay.
I did, and the first thing I would say to it is I want to re-emphasize, Chuck, something that you said, which is this bipartisan infrastructure bill, to me, is almost an accounting parity, an accounting plus-up for the last 70 years of post-war growth, where, as you said, at the macro level, we've been able to grow as a country, but We've been doing that increasingly by pushing the liabilities onto local balance sheets with water and public safety and education and so forth. And this bill, while of course it's not comprehensive in that respect, does offer the opportunity, alongside ARPA, I should be clear, alongside both ARPA, which spent $5 billion of federal funds to Massachusetts, and now the Bipartisan Infrastructure Bill, which will send between $9 to $10 billion. It's almost like we're giving ourselves a second chance at a new development practice, because we are trying to square up cities and towns with their infrastructure liabilities. Now, though, we've got to grow in a more organic, incremental way, so that we are, and as Chuck said, we are making better use of the existing infrastructure that we have, making it more productive per square mile. I am not personally going to be very supportive of further federal mandates that are unfunded for cities and towns, because I don't want to repeat the cycle that we have, that we're just trying to get our head above water from now.
I'll jump in from the state level, because this is a concern we hear frequently from local communities, and you'll see a lot of the language in bills that we file will say subject to appropriation. And that language is vital, so that you know, we're not going to force local communities to do something unless we put up the money to do it. And I think education is probably the most profound thing that we cover in the government, and to put teeth into the mandates with education reform, the Chapter 70 program has been very instrumental in providing funding. And I know the Franklin community alone gets about $28 million from the Chapter 70 program. So we're cognizant of it, and we try to put the dollars into the pockets of the local communities. The House and the Senate just recently passed the spending on the ARPA funding, and we're trying to bridge the gaps in the conference committee, but that's going to be approximately $4 billion coming back to our local communities very soon. So.
Yeah. Jeff, can I just quickly jump in there?
Yeah.
I want to build off what you just said on education, because I think it's so important. And here I may have a very slight friendly divergence from Chuck, in that I actually think increasingly it's really unfair to be asking localities to cover the majority of their education funding themselves, because the spillover benefits, the positive externalities of high quality education, whether it's early education, which we're trying to get passed in Washington right now, or K-12 education, or special education, which is probably the largest unfunded mandate at the local level in Massachusetts today. Those positive spillover benefits are so profound for the whole nation, right? But the minority of people end up working in the same town that they were educated in. That really, I think it is a national mandate increasingly, and we should be looking more and more to delocalize the onus of funding for education as much as possible, not divorcing necessarily property taxes from education, which I know are a pillar of Massachusetts politics and political economy, but plussing up cities and towns with national funds.
All right, Sarah, yours.
Hi, Sarah Mabardi, Franklin resident and community member. Something near and dear to me. What we see in our communities is reactivity from residents, and we see that in some of the questions already. What is the role for resident engagement in these decisions? And what have you seen as the catalyst for engagement? We talked about incremental organic growth, and how do we bring residents along on that journey, either a push model or reacting to what they're reacting to?
That's a great question. And I will say this in a way that I don't think anybody else should say it, or I want to say it in a little more blunt way than I think I would say in another forum. Citizen engagement, when it's done as, in a sense, engagement theater, is counterproductive in so many ways. We bring three different plans to you and ask you to comment on them, but the selection of those three plans up front was already determined, and these are three bad choices we don't really like. We come to you and ask you to put sticker charts on the walls and kind of, look at that. The example that I always give is the person comes in and they've got the sidewalk that's cracked and the road that needs to be fixed, and they would really like that community center. And then the next person comes up and they have the tree that's gone bad that needs to be taken down in front of their house, and then they would like a crosswalk put in so it's safe to cross the street. And you know what? I like that community center. And so many times we look at that type of engagement, and what we see is a mandate for a community center, as opposed to a whole bunch of small little needs that need to happen in our communities. So to me, the best public engagement, the places that I see doing the best public engagement, are breaking out of the kind of the traditional, we come to you with a plan and you comment type of format. And they've gone to more of a, let's go out on the street and see where people are at. At Strong Towns, we've developed this four-step process for public engagement, and it's very, very simple. It's number one, go out and observe where people struggle. Go out and with very deep intention, try to understand where people are struggling to use the city as it has been built. Step number two, ask yourself, what can we do with the resources we have on hand right now to make that struggle a little bit easier? And then step number three is to do that, do it right now, and step number four is to repeat that process. And so what you're doing is you're taking public engagement and you're taking the kind of insider access burden off of people, and you're saying instead, we're going to go out as humble servants in the community and try to understand where people are struggling and then use the resources we have to respond to that, allowing the feedback then to be how people respond to your response. Jane Jacobs describes cities as a co-creation, something that we build together. And I think a lot of times we look at cities as things that we pay taxes for and then are provided to us. The best models are the ones where we are out as city officials, understanding and learning and then responding and allowing the residents to, in real time through their actions, respond to the things that we're doing. So we learn together.
We've got a whole lineup of questions, so join the line there.
Hi there, Catherine Feard from the city of Attleboro, which is a little bit south of here. I'm familiar with the Strong Town model for several years now, and even before that, I've seen really creative, regenerative ideas come out of small towns across the country. My question is kind of similar to Newton, and congratulations, by the way, with the single family zoning. I've seen that in California so far, but I didn't know that you were doing it. Right. But my question is really, our city has like a dense, vibrant downtown that's really growing. It has like all of the ingredients that are necessary for a renaissance, and we're starting to see that happen. However, the rest of the city is more or less a standard suburban type build out. How do you identify the nodes to develop, and how do you deal with the congestion that that development's gonna cause, at least in the short term?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Bang.
Yeah, no, that's such a great question. I'm not worried about identifying the nodes where development is going to happen. I look at where things are going on now and say, how do we nudge this to like the next best version of itself? And how do we connect it to other things? So you've got a great downtown going. You've got the core that's starting to come back on its own. The question that I would struggle with then is, how do we connect the surrounding neighborhoods? Because a true downtown ecosystem is not just Main Street businesses and stuff going on. It's the housing, it's the relationship back and forth. And that really gets to the answer to the question, the congestion problem too. Congestion in an urban area, congestion in a city is looked at as this bane, as this huge problem. But it's the Yogi Berra-ism, you know, it's no one goes there anymore because it's so busy. I think we need to look at congestion for what it is. It's a demand to be in a place. And there's two ways to address that demand to be in the place. The way we've addressed it historically is to tear down parts of that place to accommodate more parking, wider streets, more mobility, more access. And what that does is it puts a cap on how great that place can be, and it actually limits your ability to, you know, accommodate more people and make that place really successful, in addition to stunting your tax base. There's another way to respond to that congestion though, and that is to say, congestion is good, it's a great signal of great things, let's create local alternatives to automobile trips. so that people don't have to get into their car. In other words, let's respond to the congestion by actually building more stuff. And that's a hard mental leap to make, because a lot of places, when you're in that congested environment and they're like, well, we've got this new business going in, and everyone says, no, it'll bring more cars. Yeah, it'll bring more cars. And it'll also make living three blocks away that much more valuable. So let's build those units too. And it will make demand for a local corner store where you can get milk and daily essentials all that more vital. So let's build that too. And so our answer to congestion should not be to focus on the transportation aspect of it in the city. It should be to focus on how do we build alternatives and build more stuff.
I guess I should clarify to say, you know, when we have like the single family zoning specifically as a constraint to where commercial activity can develop. So, you know, if we have like a little strip mall here, but everything behind it is single family. And obviously the congestion does say that there is a demand for goods and services. But just how do you get that ball rolling in terms of deciding, okay, well, this place is ready to grow. It's time to reconsider our zoning here. I guess that was my question.
Yeah, no, that bigger question. So at Strong Towns, we have a saying that no neighborhood should experience radical change, but no neighborhood can be exempt from change. And so if your zoning in your neighborhood puts your neighborhood under glass, if it locks it in amber and doesn't allow it to evolve, that zoning needs to change. So every neighborhood that we have in the community should be allowed to evolve to that next level of intensity. And what we talk about it as being by right. So with the minimum amount of regulatory friction to do that. In Minnesota, we have some, what I've come to learn are very unique development rules, where we have time permits on how long a city can review an application. A by right permit for us would be something that could be approved within a day. If you think about that as being like a standard of approval, we should have things in our neighborhood that you can do that would get like very quick and easy approval. What we talk about at Strong Towns is that the rate of change, if the rate of change is X, X has to be greater than zero. So if I have all single family homes, it's not okay to have zoning that just allows the same thing that's there. It's got to allow X greater than zero, something beyond a single family home.
And I can see, if I can count correctly, there are about four people who have questions. We've got about 10 minutes left. We had promised people we were going to be done at 10:30, and I know, Congressman, you have a very important bill signing to get to, so we want to be mindful of that. So before you ask your question, I do want to recognize Susan Nickel is here from Senator Spilka's office, and Senator Spilka will be joining you down in D.C. today, Congressman, but I wanted to acknowledge she's here today. Please.
Thank you. Hi, Mr. Moran. Thank you for having this. I come from Rehoboth, Massachusetts. We're a right-to-farm community. We have no public water, and we all rely on well water. I'm wondering if you have any suggestions on how to bolster the local economy. We've struggled to bring in business because of that fact. And I also was wondering if it's beneficial for a town to embrace this uniqueness. We are surrounded by more suburban communities, so I'm wondering if you have any suggestions on how we can preserve open space or kind of leverage that as like an attraction. I know agrotourism is a big industry that we're looking into, so thank you for your time.
Yeah. I'm at a little bit of a disadvantage because I don't know your community. You described it to an engineer as not having a water system. So
let's put it this way. We have no master plan, lots of farms.
Yeah.
We're developing rapidly residentially.
So you are developing rapidly.
Residentially,
yeah.
But no commercial.
Right. So I feel like the question that I would have, or the thing that I would struggle with, is that trade-off, that kind of classic trade-off from that we talk about in this book here, of that short-term growth versus the long-term liability. A lot of communities that are in your position are experiencing rapid growth because that growth can be done very easily. We have lots of systems from, you know, the housing market and infrastructure building and what have you to
Can I interrupt? So we're in a phase of transition. It's pretty unique, but industrial-wise, a lot of the farms are selling their property
right.
Because farming is is a difficult job. So
yes.
Once that land, large swaths of land become available and we just can't compete as a town through our conservation programs to save the land, and then individuals, you know, not everybody wants to buy a farm, so.
Well, as someone who grew up on a farm, and know exactly what you mean, it makes me very sad to hear what's going on.
It's created a lot of polarization in our community. So
yes.
Representative Auchincloss said really resonated in terms of a top-down model where he worked with that in Newton, I think you said?
Newton, yep.
That clicked.
Let me try to tie two things together real quick so we can get to these others before I know we run out of time. As someone who grew up on a farm and as someone who has a high value on agriculture and a farming lifestyle, farmers grasp that slash and burn agriculture is not a sustainable model for farming. They get that. Conservative farmers get that, progressive farmers get that. Everybody gets that you have to have the soil regenerate itself. You have to take care of your farm. When we look at the type of development that you're describing, the type that comes into farms, just builds residential development, no real commercial center, no node, no like neighborhood development. What you're looking at is financially the equivalent of slash and burn agriculture. It is a one generational type of investment that will not regenerate itself and sustain itself over time. So to me, I would use my regulatory capacity in your city to not have that happen. I would protect those farms through zoning, through other means. But I'm also gonna turn to some of the early questioners, like the woman right here, and say, I think this is another argument for thickening up your neighborhoods, for dealing with that single family zoning issue. Because if you don't, what you do is you wind up denuding your region. You wind up doing great damage to yourselves as not just a city, but as a broader community.
All right. Are we down to two more questions? Alan, you're gonna still ask your question? All right, we've got...
I'll be quick.
Great, thank you.
I appreciate it. Yeah, thanks for being here and Representative. My name is Gail Mook. I'm the Executive Director of MassBike, or the Massachusetts Bicycle Coalition, so I'm gonna have a transportation-related question. Full disclosure, I grew up in Northern Virginia in a planned community called Reston. So if you know well, it was quite a shock when I came to Massachusetts and saw the lack of planning. And there's kind of an issue of what I saw here of the default mechanism for how we develop our transportation system obviously relies on the automobile. And that's explicitly and implicitly implied. So, you know, for instance, the federal funding that comes from FHWA that most impacts biking, walking, and transit is called transportation alternatives. This is an alternative to driving. And subtle ways, such as the invitation to come today, mentioned ample parking across the street, on the street, and next to the street, but failed to mention that we have a commuter rail stop 200 feet away and a link to the schedule. I don't mean that as an intention, I just mean to reinforce the fact that we always think of it as a side note. So my question is essentially, how do we move away from it being an alternative? And this is a little bit less for you, Chuck, but a little bit more to the representatives and electeds in the room. And to beg the answer, I do want to mention that we are 30 years in from the largest, most recent civil rights bill of the American Disabilities Act, which is, to get Brett's first question, more or less an unfunded mandate that requires us to think about more than just able-bodied folks. So is there a similar connection that we can make, local, state, and federally, to remove the concept of biking and walking and transit as being a nice additive, but making it more of an essential in the transportation system? And how can that be done local, state, and federally? And how can advocates support that? And I don't mean to throw shade on anybody who drove, full disclosure, I drove here as well, but just the concept of it needing to be at the baseline of it, and is there a way to make it mandated so that it is required?
Thank you. So let me jump in with one thing. It's a good thing you didn't take the commuter rail this morning. I was talking with Rep Dooley earlier. It was a 40-minute delay on the train. So,
yep.
You know, one of the great frustrations for folks, what was that?
Classic.
Is the reliability of our public transportation system. And building upon that, I share your enthusiasm for biking. I didn't share your enthusiasm for public transportation. But if we're not going to build a resilient and reliable system, people are not going to use it. And I think we're seeing that in this COVID. The roads are more busy today than I think I've ever seen. But that's the infrastructure we should be focusing on.
Mm-hmm. Turn it over to you.
Representative Auchincloss, you want to take this one? I feel like I've been talking the whole time here, so I'm...
Given that we're short on time, I will be very brief. Galen, I fully agree with what you're putting forward, and suffice to say that over the last 9 months of negotiations with the infrastructure bill and now the Build Back Better Act, we've been fighting in T&I for this mindset, and have gotten some good grant programs and policy changes in there. I'll just say if I had to give just one answer, though, it would be parking. I think parking is upstream of so much of what we see with our car-centric infrastructure as a country, and with the fact that we don't prioritize and emphasize alternatives. To the extent that we subsidize parking, to the extent that we presume that parking should be free or at least severely underpriced to what it's actually worth, we are going to have car-centric policies.
The representative and I had some great discussions on parking, and I could not agree more. I'm just going to add to this. The highest returning investment that a city can make right now is in biking and walking infrastructure, period, bar none. Mm-hmm. If we want to make our cities more successful for more people, we will invest in it. I think it's also critically important that we not look at biking and walking as a recreational activity. It can be that, but our investments need to be in it as transportation. If you want to build a great street, a great place, it needs to prioritize the humans in that space, biking and walking infrastructure, as opposed to the mobility and the throughput of traffic through that place. And that is a policy shift that, the representative has supported. I think we can start to make changes at. The state can be leaders on making that shift, and local leaders can demand that they do so.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question, come on up. I think we're, if I see in the queue, there's three more questions, correct?
I'll be very brief.
All right.
Hi, my name's Courtney Starling. I'm the land use director for the town of Dover. I actually am a planner. Everybody's super fans. I'm pretty excited. I don't usually see that. My question is actually practical, and it's about capacity building on the other side of funding. We are absolutely thrilled to death to be getting infrastructure funding. I work for an affluent community, but that does not mean that we have all the money in the world to do all the things that we need to do. The issue that we are encountering, though, is that with the flood of money that is coming out and the variety of programs, both at the state level and the local level, we're really struggling, both to keep up and also with the requirements for the grants. If you apply for one thing, you are barred from other programs, for example. And there's a real lack of capacity on the other side. My concern is that if I ever am successfully able to get something funded, I don't readily have capacity to do like Davis-Bacon wage reporting for federal funding. There are a lot of things on the administrative side. Most grant funds have very severe caps on admin. There's a shortage of people who know how to do these things to boot. And so we're thrilled about money, but the money needs to be easier to get, and it also, I think, needs to have some recognition. It, with the money that we've already gotten, it's delayed a bunch of different grants that are our typical grants on the state level because of capacity, because, they're busy with ARPA or they're busy with other programs, and so we're seeing delays on normal business. And then to boot, with the new money, there's not much guidance out there because everything is new and it's a lot to navigate. And I'm given to understand there's 17 new infrastructure programs in the bill that's coming. And my question is there any thought to making it easier on the capacity building side to actually implement these great things? I mean, I understand like the systemic issues that block us from being able to do things. But let's say we get the zoning, let's say we get everything else, we still need the water system, we need to grant fund it. I need a 20% local match, so I'm gonna have to get approved at town meeting, which is maybe not going to happen because of, that'll go with the idea that something will be built. There's, issues, I would say, and my question is, what thought is being given on the administrative side to make this possible? To make the implementation. Let's just go ahead and just assume that we all agree on what the good things are. and let's say that we're going to go implement, we actually do the zoning changes, how do we get the capacity? How do we, especially in a state where we don't regionalize, where home rule is king, how do we make it so that a person like me who works for a town that has 6,000 people in it, that I'm the only person who does anything remotely related to land use on staff to be able to get to benefit from this for my community?
Chief.
I think Congress, I think in the most, the most direct sense, right, is there, with part of this bill, is there any practical steps to improve the implementation of funding to project?
In the Build Back Better Act, there are grants for municipalities for capacity. In this bipartisan infrastructure bill, I'll double check this, but I think the short answer is no. This is directly for infrastructure, not for the administrative.
Even if there were provisions to buy the software that does the data bacon reporting, because you either have to have a human doing that or software, and the software costs money. And again, this goes back to the general fund and going back to town meeting. This stuff is hard.
I'm the outsider here, and so I don't have to live. I'm going home at the end of this week.
But just keep in mind, this is a good problem to have.
Yeah,
to have this kind of money to spend on infrastructure. Let's keep that in mind.
Oh, yeah.
We are in unprecedented times.
I'm like a geek, but I do have these things on the other side that, A, I'm having a hard time applying for money and bringing it home because it's...
Right.
I mean, some of these grants are like 20, 40 hours of work and you need a specialist, not someone like me.
Well, there's a couple of things here. For me, that I'm going to react to, and I know we need to keep this moving. Let me point out a couple of things. I think first of all, so often our local governments have oriented themselves vertically. And when I started this conversation by saying I'm investing in this relationship, I think what we see today an urgent need for local government to orient horizontally. Orient around the urgent needs of people in the community as opposed to what the next grant program or the next thing that they can do. In my city right now, we're very focused on children's museums. We want to get a children's museum, and you would think that it's like the most critical thing. It is so far down on the list, but the reason children's museum is dominating our conversation is because there's a grant program at the state for children's museum. And there's an organization in town that is working on applying for that grant and has made it front and center. I think that what we need to see is a lot more focus horizontally in local government, with the question then, what of the programs that do have grants is worth our time and energy to go after? And that may mean, and you started the conversation by saying you're from an affluent place, I am more concerned with the very poor communities that really need the federal grant to bridge that gap, to make some things that's falling behind work. How do they have the capacity to do that? How do they find the mechanism to do that? I have worked with a lot of places that are 6,000, that have affluence, that maybe qualify for the federal grant, but it's not the most important thing. I'm not really worried about that. I realize it's a burden for you, I get it, and you're going to say something nicer.
We have manganese in our water supply. I can't just tell my residents here affluent take care of it.
Let me jump in because we only have time for one more question, but if we can get these two last questions that are up there, very brief and very brief answers, we have time for two more questions. And thank you for everyone for being here.
Hi. My name is Heather Hamilton. I'm the current chair of the select board for the town of Brookline. Let me just kind of describe a scenario for you. So Brookline has great transit.
And I just said briefly.
Yes. I'll be brief, don't worry. So we have transit, and one of the greatest pleasures that I've had is to be able to address the zoning along transit corridors. That's what we can do as a town. But what I can't do, which I'm frustrated by, because I can do it with roads, is linkages when developers come. I want development along transit corridors, but I can't get developers to help the MBTA by asking and requesting for linkage fees. So I just wanted to demonstrate that this is frustration, that we could be getting more money out of the development that we want along transit, but I have no mechanism to do it because of the bifurcation between state and local. Thank you.
Not sure there's a response to that question. We'll take that as, you want
to? Well, just jump that, in. That we'll continue to push the state level to ensure that the MBTA is working with our local communities and being as effective as they can.
Well, you're looking at someone who wrote a letter to the MBTA on July 28th. Yes. On the stopping of a double track project when it's 90% complete. I don't understand that type of a process, but looking for a response, and I'm staying on top of them because we need to finish that double track infrastructure to move people and make the system more reliable. So that's the one linkage that I'll.
This is what I'll say. At transit corridors, I think you're getting at a funding issue. I'm not as familiar with it. The most important connections you can make when you're developing around a transit stop are the bike walk connections. And you can do those through zoning, through your regulatory process, and those are like the critical ones that will make that system work.
All right, question.
Hi, my name's Brian Cole. I'm on the planning board in Milford, where you can absolutely buy a house for less than $1 million. So one issue that we've been having is with a certain online retailer who will remain nameless. They've really come in over the last couple of years and frankly caught us with our pants down. There are distribution centers, there are warehouses, there are glorified parking lots all over the community. How do we as a small town with limited resources, you know, coexist and stick up for ourselves, for lack of a better word, against someone with that kind of muscle?
It's a really difficult question. And I think what you're asking, let me turn it like this. I don't feel like you're asking an actual like regulatory government function kind of question. You're really asking a cultural question, because you have the tools to say no to any of those things if you didn't want them. And I think the struggle with most places is that these are looked at as a net good, a net positive for the community. Mm-hmm. I question that. I feel you questioning that. Mm-hmm. But I think the thing you're struggling with is how do we communicate that to others? Because other people are seeing the jobs, they're seeing the tax base, they're seeing the investment, and they're saying that's a net good. Mm. And that the answer to that is really difficult, because that requires you to have a tough conversation with your neighbors. I think that we can, at the state level, not make that problem worse by going in and subsidizing all those highway connections in that place. Mm-hmm. The state of Massachusetts put out 2 years ago a big report on congestion and traffic congestion and made it the top transportation priority, reducing traffic congestion. I would not make it the top transportation priority. I would make local biking and walking the top transportation priority, and I would allow congestion to sort itself out in that. But that is a discussion that, you know, you're going to have in your community, because I don't think that anyone can solve that for you.
Sure. All right. Thank you.
Now, Alan, did you have a question, and can you make it extremely quick? I saw you patiently put your hand up.
Thanks, Representative Roy. I can make it really quick. It's sort of a comment and a question. Two things. First, a lot of talk about sustainability, which is wonderful, and you guys have provided some really great information on models we can use here in Franklin. But our node, if you will, the train station, that transportation is permanently subsidized. It's not really sustainable. Only bus transportation comes close to breaking even in most metropolitan areas, including this one. That, I think, should be figured into the talk about making places sustainable, A, and B, where's the regional context? Because Franklin became what it is now, a small city, because Boston became untenable. The transportation ghetto of Roxbury and Dorchester has prevented density there. So those are really comments. I don't think they're quite questions, but I thought I'd throw those things in. Thank you.
Well, thank you. First of all, I want to say thank you to everyone for coming. Congressman Auchincloss, thank you for being here and making extraordinary measures to be here, because that's your commitment to the community, and we continue to thank you for that. And thank you, Chuck, for a great presentation. Kobe,
great idea, putting putting this thought in my head, and that's why you're a talented young man and you're doing so well at such a young age. So thank you, everyone, and I look forward to seeing you again. Jake, you want to make any final words?
No, just that I appreciate everybody coming. Chuck, thank you in particular for making your way here to the Massachusetts 4th. And everyone have a great week.
Thank you, Cogsworth.
Thank you.
We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tin Type Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. By the way, you can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.